This is an ABC podcast.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week, we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So Priya, I caught you talking to a machine the other day. You feeling okay?
I openly disclosed it to you and I did it because a lot of people have written into us and said, Priya, you need to try AI.
So was this any AI? What did you try?
So I used ChatGPT for the first time ever. I feel like I'm very late to the party. And I put in some little worries that I had and some potential scenarios, patient scenarios, and just saw what it might do in the therapy space.
Well, I haven't done that. I wouldn't trust myself to do it, but maybe I should.
That was our homework, Norman.
I know. I failed in my homework. I never used to do it at school and I don't do it now. I'm so sorry. But AI psychotherapy is a big part of today's health report.
I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land.
I'm Norman Swan on Gadigal Land.
Also on the show, we're going to talk about de-prescribing, getting rid of medications, particularly as we age.
Yeah, it must make people a bit anxious.
Yes, it can.
You've got to come off that. You get quite dependent on the thought of being on them rather than dependent on the drug itself.
I actually find it very hard as a clinician to actually put my brain into gear and go, let's get rid of stuff. I'm good at putting it on, but it's not always that easy.
What's on news?
There is good news, Norman, which I think we should really celebrate. There's a study that's been published in The Lancet, which has looked at what's happened to screening rates for cervical cancer in Australia since self-collection was introduced. Now, we need to go back in time. People might remember that 10 years ago, if you were going to go and have your cervical screening test, you were getting what was known as a pap smear, a speculum examination. In July 2022, self-collection, the ability for someone to actually do their own swab or have a clinician do it without a speculum, was widely available. They opened it up to everybody and said anyone 25 to 74 who needs the test can consider self-collection. So this study has looked at what are the screening rates and is self-collection as effective as me potentially taking the sample in the consulting room? And it's good news because it's shown that A, it's very effective, so it's really good at detecting abnormalities, the self-collect test, and B, the screening rates have gone up in really underscreened groups, people who hadn't had a test for 10 years, people living in really remote and regional areas, First Nations women, women aged 70 to 74, people who were not getting screened because it was either traumatic or uncomfortable or socially or culturally unacceptable. The rates in these groups has gone up, and that is awesome news. That is, you know, equity for cancer screening. We are on track to eliminate cervical cancer by 2035. And this is a good news story.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It really is good because it was really proving highly intractable how to get to hard to reach groups and women who just simply didn't like the process of getting up in stirrups and having a speculum put in. Now they can do it themselves much more comfortably and seems to be getting over major barriers.
Yes, and it's effective. I think a lot of people are still reluctant. If I talk to patients, they go, oh, is it as reliable? Yes, it is. The test is just looking for human papillomavirus or HPV. Whether you do the test or I do the test, we're equally effective at actually picking it up.
In fact, there was a little bit of evidence in the study that it was more effective at picking up HPV. And speaking of HPV, there's also been a study looking at the long-term effects of HPV vaccination or immunization in reducing the risk of cervical cancer. And it's a Swedish study of about nearly a million women followed for up to 18 years, which shows that there is no waning of effect. So in other words, the reduction in the risk of cervical cancer is sustained for at least up to 18 years, which is also great news. Mm. It also confirmed that the risk reduction was greatest when it was given at the ages of 10 to 12 rather than later on in adolescence. So it didn't, the risk didn't go, just to explain, the risk didn't go down to zero. The risk was reduced by about 80% in 10 to 12 year olds.
If you were vaccinated versus unvaccinated.
That's right. So why is it still 20% and not 100%? Well, it could be that you get infected by a form of the virus that's not covered by the vaccine. It's also possible that some of these older kids were already infected with HPV. So there are many, many reasons, and also that the vaccine isn't necessarily 100% effective in its own right. But nonetheless, that's a massive reduction in the risk of cervical cancer, which is sustained, and it supports the National Immunization Program, which encourages immunization at a younger age in adolescence.
And I think it's worth pointing out, because I just mentioned that stat about Australia's on track to eliminate cervical cancer by 2035, that that is due to the vaccination program and due to screening. They are hand in hand, both required. And if you are vaccinated, you still need cervical cancer screening.
And boys need to be vaccinated as well, because it's boys who give the girls the HPV, but also they can have HPV infection themselves, causing esophageal cancer, pharyngeal cancer, and anal cancer. So boys benefit from this too.
In other good news, there's been research published in JAMA which has looked at the benefits of physical activity after cancer diagnosis, and it specifically looked at bladder, endometrial, kidney, lung, oral, ovarian, and rectal cancer.
Yeah, and some really difficult to treat cancers like ovarian and rectal.
Yes, and it's looked at several studies. So there's just over 17,000 people who've been included. And the takeaway is that moderate to vigorous physical activity after cancer diagnosis does help you live beyond cancer. So it improves, it's got an improved mortality. So we did a story on this, do you remember last year?
We've been doing regular stories.
Yeah, well, maybe before my time. But we did it. Do you remember I got very excited in an interview about colorectal cancer and the benefits of physical activity after in a structured exercise program?
You get excited so often that I, you know,
it all matches.
But I'll take your word for it. No, seriously, of course I do.
We're going to link that in the show notes because people might want to listen to it again. But look, this just confirms that movement after a cancer diagnosis is good for you.
But it's not just any movement. You've really got to progress. You've got to do moderate to vigorous physical activity, which means activity that leaves you a bit breathless and you can't have a conversation when you're doing it, but which is what's recommended anyway. So it means that exercise becomes part of cancer therapy.
Mm. And it should be prescribed with structured exercise programs and support for people. Well, imagine that world where I know it can exist in silos, but imagine if everybody had access to exercise physiologists and Pilates machines, Norman.
You're listening to the Very Active Health Report here on Radio National.
A lot of people have written into us, Norman, telling us about AI and the potential benefits. Our mailbag is often filled with people's anecdotes, some of them positive, some people saying this is the traps for beginners. And I made a new friend and I delved in. I've dipped my toe and I've tried it out.
Did your new friend have a little name, an imaginary name?
Well, it was ChatGPT, but do people name it? Is that what I'm meant to do?
I don't know.
Can I say I can see how people become friends with AI? It was incredibly nice. It was my first ever experience and it was very nice to me.
Which they're trained to do. They're trained to be nice and make you happy. And
yeah. It was validating, acknowledged my feelings. I put in a little rumination that I had, a little worry that I had, and it gave me quite clear strategies. It told me about the spotlight effect and that probably no one even noticed what I'd done because they're all too worried about themselves and I should go and do some breath work. It did some gentle cognitive reframing. But then when I popped in more complex potential scenarios that I knew from the consulting room, it did start to fall down.
And I was supposed to do this too, but I didn't, maybe because I'm too heavily defended. But, you know, I am worried about giving my information to ChatGPT. I just don't necessarily trust the whole system. But people,
you can make it up. Make it up, Norman.
So I become somebody else.
Yeah, that's what I did.
Right. What was your pseudonym?
I didn't. You want the...
This is Frida here. Frida from Warrnambool wants to know.
To be fair, I'm with you on this because I actually didn't log in. And if I'm honest, I used it on several different devices so it couldn't track me. So right. I'm also sceptical.
But seriously, this is a major issue. People going into one of these AI systems, asking for health advice, but at the more complex end, it is actually this interaction when you're needing some psychological help or psychological support. So Priya and I thought we'd get in somebody who's been a pioneer in online psychotherapy and also researching it, Professor Jill Newby, who is a clinical psychologist at the University of New South Wales and the Black Dog Institute.
So online psychological therapy usually consists of either a smartphone app or an online program where there's modules that get released in a certain sequence. There might be a 6-module program. Each of those modules delivers psychoeducation about the condition that it's treating and teaches practical strategies. So it's kind of more informational, information that you read, you might watch videos or look into other content and then learn for yourself and apply those skills to your own daily life. The difference with AI conversational agents is you might type in a question, it will come up with an answer. It feels more like a human connection because there is a conversation, a lot of validation and a lot of feeling of support.
Is it fair to say though, Jill, that the programs you're referring to, these online modules are validated, they're actually tested, we know that they're safe and effective?
Yeah, that's right. So we've done a lot of research at Black Dog. I used to work at St Vincent's Hospital. There's many experts around Australia. There's probably over 100 randomised controlled trials of digital or online therapies for depression and anxiety disorders.
But not AI.
Not AI. It's kind of an evidence desert. There's a lot of trials that are going on to test the use of AI chatbots in therapy. There's probably about 30, 35 trials that are ongoing in the US alone. But there's not a whole lot of published research that has properly evaluated these tools.
Do we know how they're trained?
There's one that's specific for mental health support and advice, but then there's also the off-label use of generic chatbots like ChatGPT. So my understanding of the training models for ChatGPT is it's trained on vast amount of written information from the entire internet. Some of the mental health chatbots are trained on more specific information around cognitive behavioural therapy manuals and other therapeutic techniques.
So what did you try, Priya?
Well, I tried ChatGPT and I have to be open about this, Jill. I did it for this, so we knew what we were dealing with. I actually had quite a positive experience. It was quite responsive and gave me some practical tools to deal with some worries that I had. And I can see what you're saying, that it is quite engaging and conversational. Do we think that's a big reason as to why people are turning to it? They feel heard and validated?
It's incredibly validating. It's incredibly supportive.
Or they're programmed for that. They want to be engaging.
They want to be engaging. They want people to keep using it. And it's really nice to actually interact with.
But notoriously with ChatGPT, that's its weakness because they try to please the person and you can break the glass. As one case in California, a young person finding means to take their own life. And when they traced the conversation with ChatGPT, they broke the glass and the guardrails that were supposed to be there disappeared because ChatGPT wanted to please the person.
Yes, exactly. And no matter what question you ask, it's always, that's a great question.
Yes.
Congratulations on the most beautiful question that's ever been asked. And that's quite lovely to hear as an end user, but it's not always the best thing for people when they're using it for mental health support and advice. But it is a really helpful tool for a lot of people. And like you said, Priya, it can provide really helpful coping strategies for people to manage their mental health or worries or day-to-day stresses. And that can be a good thing in making that kind of support more available in comparison to other types of mental health support. And we also need to be clear that not all clinicians are validating and they may say the wrong thing that really upsets a client and that could mean the end of that therapy and that might turn off a person completely.
So there is this notion, psychologists often say, beat themselves up and they say, oh, the client never came back. I saw them once and they never came back. They must have hated me or, I just don't know what happened there. And there have been researchers looking at people who never come back. And the answer is often, well, you told me what to do. I got it. And I feel much better. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And it's translated into what's called single session therapy,
yeah,
where psychologists are trained, do the session as if the patient might never come back so that they get everything there. Is there any sense that AI is trained as a single session thing?
Oh, I don't know, but I think that's a really interesting area of research and something that we could actually test out is a single session therapy
with an AI chatbot. As long as Priya and I go on the paper, we're fine.
Yes. You can be co-authors or acknowledged, I don't know. Yeah. Depends on your contribution. If you write it for me, then that'd be fantastic.
Our bot will speak to your bot.
I think it's a really interesting idea because you're right. Some people who have a single session may be turned off, but you're right. Some people might get what they need out of that session. We've looked at a bit of that question in online therapies as well. So we took a look at how people improved before they dropped out. And we found that 40% of people who dropped out early had had a significant improvement in distress. So it's kind of like they got what they needed out of the program and then left because the motivation wanes when you're not distressed anymore. So I think it's a really interesting idea.
Now, you mentioned you worked at St Vincent's Hospital in Sydney where Kruf had developed an online system which was supervised by psychologists, so psychologists could intervene with a level of severity. What do we know about the need for psychologists to be there somewhere rather than entirely online?
I was going to say as an adjuvant almost, because you might be using this chatbot as an adjuvant to psychology, right? It's safer with a psychologist as well?
We believe it's safer with a psychologist or a health professional supporting it, but there isn't actually any research that's been testing that for AI chatbots. We do know for online therapies, like the ones that are delivered at St Vincent's Hospital, that self-guided programs that are done completely without any health professional support can be beneficial and they can improve symptoms. But for people with moderate to severe symptoms of depression, clinician support is more effective. There's a couple of reasons why. It keeps people accountable and makes sure there's safeguards in place that can help manage safety if someone's deteriorating or has suicidal thinking throughout the program. But it can also be more beneficial for engagement. It helps people stay on track, stay with the program, so they're continuing with the program and getting those tools and strategies rather than a self-guided program because people tend to drop out. It's really hard to do things on your own.
One of the advantages to the online programs has been that the computer sticks to the protocol. I might well be out of date, but the last time I looked, you know, 3 centuries ago, the older a psychologist was, the longer they'd been in practice, the less effective they were at cognitive behavioral therapy because they felt they could deviate from the protocol. And the online programs are designed according to the protocol. Have we got any idea then about, well, first of all, let's go back to online. Is that still true, that there's a real problem getting psychologists adhering to the protocols that make these cognitive behavioral therapies work?
Yes, what you're calling is therapist drift, where the further you are out from the training, you drift away from what's the evidence-based manualized protocol for that particular condition. And you're right, as people become more experienced, they rely on their judgment and experience as opposed to delivering the specific techniques that are part of that protocol. I agree, online programs, that is one of the benefits of that standardization across people. So rather than the clinician necessarily making a judgment about what the client should be doing or what they might benefit from most or using the formulation to drive the strategies that they're teaching, no matter who you are and where you come from, you're getting the same content. And that's really important for standardization and consistent quality across clients. For the AI chatbots, it's bit of an unknown at the moment because it is so conversational. It does adjust to your own unique features and way of interacting with the technology. And that means there isn't consistency across patients.
And you don't know what the toolkit is, whether it's dialectical behavioral therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy or what, which they have an evidence base, but you don't know what toolbox they're pulling from.
Yeah, exactly. And the evidence base might differ. One might be recommended over another. So I tested it out also around OCD type symptoms. And I was testing it out and saying, is it normal to repeatedly check locks over and over again? And the tool came back to me and said, well, that could be a sign of anxiety or it could be a sign of OCD. And here's the strategies I suggest. There was things about, you know, setting a routine, setting a particular time of day when I check the locks in my house. But then the second strategy it suggested was mindfulness. And then the third was cognitive behavioral therapy. That's actually not the right order in which we need to treat OCD. Actually, it should be exposure and response prevention, which is a particular type of cognitive behavioral therapy, which relies more on the behaviour, so managing the behaviours in OCD. Mindfulness isn't indicated at the moment for OCD. And actually, people with OCD with moderate to severe symptoms probably should be considering antidepressants or other medications to help manage their anxiety. So the order in which the chatbot gave me advice was actually not in line with what we would suggest clinically.
And exposure is probably quite hard to do on a computer, because this is the idea of you ideate your fear and then you confront your fear and you move towards it. It's a bit like a phobia type treatment. must be quite hard to do on a
Well, you need support for that, really, through a psychologist, ideally. Like, I have no patients that are doing that on their own, Jill. I just wondered, though, when I tested it, I kind of put together some of the more complex patient presentations that I see, and I did notice that it oversimplified things, that it perhaps didn't get the interaction between an eating disorder and OCD tendencies and this crossover that can occur. Is that one of the risks here, that it is oversimplifying things for people?
Yes, and that's what the research seems to show at the moment. It's really early days in testing out these models and figuring out how accurate and reliable they are. But some of the research that I've read suggests that for more simpler or standard presentations, ChatGPT and other tools do quite well in providing general mental health advice, sensible coping strategies that are fairly evidence-based, but the more complex and severe conditions, it doesn't do as well at. You know, differential diagnoses like eating disorders versus depression versus trauma or other kinds of anxiety or stress-related disorders, it can't really differentiate between those, and that's where it becomes a bit more risky and a bit more concerning.
How on earth do you do a study, a trial of AI therapy? I mean, it's been hard enough to do CBT trials, and people have criticised them, saying, well, it's hard to replicate the trials that have been done, and you don't measure harms very well with CBT. Every treatment's got a harm. What are the harms? How do you do it when it's a black box?
That's a really tricky thing. There was a trial last year that came out on Therabot, which was a generative AI tool for depression and anxiety and weight and shape concerns. And that was a really interesting study because it was the first one that came out that was a clinical trial to evaluate a generative AI tool for mental health. It's really difficult because the model might change. And so it's impossible to replicate if the model changes that underlies that clinical trial. But in clinical trials, we want things to be standardized and static, and we want things to be kept the same. So we know that what these participants got is a standard program that we can replicate. But that doesn't exist in generative AI, or it's very difficult to do. So one trial that might have been done last year, we can't replicate it because it's a new model that's being used this year.
For people using it, Jill, how do you do it as safely as possible? People are going to it. It's free. It's available. There are a lot of barriers to seeing people. What's your kind of takeaways?
If you are using it, then to make sure that you are seeing or talking with a health professional, because there could be a range of other conditions that might explain what you're going through that the AI chatbot might not recognise or understand or provide you support with. So that's one thing we are recommending at the moment, that you use it in conjunction with a health professional. If that is not possible for some reason, then it's really important to think about safety and severity. So if you have more severe symptoms, if you experience suicidal thinking or thoughts of harm to others, then don't use these tools. We don't think they're safe. There are not enough safeguards in place to use those, and they can exacerbate more severe mental health conditions. But that said, if you're using it for everyday worries and everyday stresses and some education and coping advice, then they're probably pretty okay to use. You just need to be skeptical about the information you're reading. It feels very trustworthy because it's written with confidence. It is validating. It's comforting. The tools are designed for you to keep on using it. So you just need to be skeptical that not all the information you're reading is correct and can be either misleading or harmful.
And presumably one screening thought that's worth having is what's going on in my mind impairing my work, impairing my life, impairing my family life? If it's doing that, then that's when you really need to see a real human being.
Yeah, because real human beings have many years of training. You know, as psychologists, we go through at least 6+ years of training to deliver therapies like CBT. And that includes assessment and diagnosis and determining what is the condition that a person is experiencing? Are there any other explanations? What is the right course of treatment? Should they be referred for medication-based therapies in conjunction with psychological therapies? And all of that really matters because it could change the course of the treatment and the treatments you recommend.
So here's the clanger. This hasn't been an interview with Jill Newby. It's been an interview with ChatGPT. Just joking.
Jill, just kidding.
Jill, thanks very much. It's been illuminating.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Jill Newby, who's Professor of Clinical Psychology at the University of New South Wales and the Black Dog Institute. If you've heard anything or this has triggered something in you where you feel that you need some help, we're not recommending you go to ChatGPT. We recommend you go to Lifeline. And the number for Lifeline is 131114.
We did do a call out on the ABC Health Instagram because we wanted to hear from people who had used something like ChatGPT for mental health or life advice, and we did get a couple of responses. The first person is Dani Zetzer, who's a lawyer and parent to six children, and she uses AI to help deal with her big to-do list, but also for support with her ADHD.
Just talk into it and say, this is everything I've got to do when I'm feeling overwhelmed. And because I had trained her to know who my team were, she was like, I reckon you should delegate that to this person, that to this person. And that was really helpful. With ADHD, like I definitely get rejection sensitivity. So something will upset me. And I know myself enough, okay, pause, take a breath, don't react. But instead of going to all my friends, who, let's be honest, are not objective because they love me and they, you know, want the best for me, it's really cool to be able to say, this just happened and I'm feeling really upset. You know, can you help break it down for me? One thing you've really got to be careful with is like ChatGPT is set up to be a yes man, right? It's a people pleaser. So I always, you know, do the caveat, you know, like, please give me a reality check here. Tell it to me straight. So I use those catchphrases because sometimes I'm overreacting and I want to know. I don't want someone, whether it's AI or a human, to keep saying, yeah, you're right. And, you know, they shouldn't have said that to you. So, yeah, it's been helpful with that. I don't plan on AI ever replacing my psychologist, right? I think it's dangerous to rely on AI for therapy, especially when it relates to trauma. But I think it definitely improves accessibility. But I like to think of AI as a thinking partner, right? Not a therapist.
So I'm going to have a go now and say, look, I've got this co-host, Alexander, you know, God, can you just help solve my problems here? You can do for me, you know, and see what it says. Maybe we should do that.
We don't have any problems, do we?
No.
Well, none.
No, if we do, I'm just going to tell ChatGPT. I wouldn't dream of telling you. But seriously, Dani sounds incredibly sensible about the way she approaches it. For Lauren, she was already using ChatGPT for practical help with work and naturally turned to the chatbot when stress started building up.
And it kind of flagged me about burnout. So from there, I scheduled an appointment with my doctor, spoke to my doctor about that. Then from there, I did end up taking some time out from work, but then talking to ChatGPT about what should I do? Like things weren't getting better at work. Should I leave? And if I was going to leave, what kind of role would be more appropriate for where I am currently at? And because I kind of rated what the advice was, you know, some of it is quite like validating your feelings. So I am aware of that, that it's kind of biased. But, you know, the other big problem is once you find a good doctor, it's really hard to get into your GP. And so you need something in the meantime to help you with those coping mechanisms. And ChatGPT really helped me with those things. So setting some boundaries. So, you know, at least getting through the work week, these are the things that you should be doing each day. So I find it as a good interim measure.
So clearly, seriously, I mean, it's a serious issue. So if somebody comes to see you, they can't get in for another 2 or 3 weeks because your books are filled. It would probably be quite good for there to be a controlled, well-tested AI system attached to your practice so that you knew if someone like Lauren had called in and you got a report on that conversation, almost like a pathology result.
Yeah, I mean, aren't we so far off that though?
I mean,
what happens to the data and the... Look, if there was a validated tool, what Jill is saying, you know, is potentially in the works and maybe with more research. I think now though people have a very clear understanding of how to potentially do it if you're doing it, and ideally it doesn't replace a qualified health professional like a psychologist in your life, if that's what you need.
And just remember, and I'll refer listeners back to our conversation with Enrico Coera a few weeks ago, which is you've got no guarantee that it's confidential.
You're with The Health Report on ABC Radio National. We don't often talk about getting rid of medications. On the Health Report, we often talk about what you could potentially add. But this notion of deprescribing, Norman, getting rid of medications is something that we don't often do very well as clinicians. I will put my hand up. I often have to have more courage to get rid of stuff than to actually prescribe something.
One of the words we got taught on when I was a medical student back in, you know, the 19th century was where we were taught clinical therapeutics, in other words, about drugs and so on. And the first thing they did when somebody came into the ward with an acute illness, they stopped all their medications.
Wow.
Every single one of them just stopped. But they were in hospital and being monitored, and then just build back the medications they needed. So they might have come in on 9 and they go home on 1.
We don't do it like that anymore.
No. Well, they were in hospital.
Yeah. Okay. So they were monitored. Look, the Therapeutic Goods Administration, the TGA people would know it as, have released guidelines on how to de-prescribe for clinicians, because particularly as we get older, being on too many medications might be problematic. So to talk about de-prescribing, I spoke to a medication detective, is what she calls herself, Deborah Hawthorne, who's a consultant pharmacist in rural Victoria.
So the definition of polypharmacy really does change depending on where you are in the world and really what area you're working in. But generally speaking, it's 5 or more medications. And then there's also the term ultra polypharmacy, which is 9 or more medicines.
So why is it risky, particularly as people get older?
Yeah, so there's about 2 million people in Australia alone that are experiencing polypharmacy. But I think it's really important to mention here that polypharmacy is not necessarily bad. So there's polypharmacy and then there's inappropriate polypharmacy. So inappropriate polypharmacy is when the medicines might potentially be causing harm, but often being on 5 or more medications can be really appropriate for the person.
So when you say causing harm, it might be that a particular medicine is making someone feel lightheaded, it might increase their risk of falls, but also if you're on lots of different medications that they might potentially interact and cause problems because they don't agree with each other. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. So you've got the side effects, but also the drug interactions. And then, you know, we can go into things on more of a cellular level and people's bodies change over time. And even our bodies can affect medicines differently. For example, something like chronic kidney disease, it can also change the way your body utilizes medication or gets rid of it or metabolizes it. So lots of different things when it comes to inappropriate polypharmacy.
How many people does it put in hospital? Do we have a rough estimate on the kind of impact it can have?
Look, they say there's about 250,000 admissions to hospital every year from medication misadventure. So that would include things like polypharmacy, but it would also include things like overdose or underdose or all those sorts of things. But it's definitely a high contributor. And often we hear about something called medication misadventure. So, you know, we could be on so many medicines that things can get really tricky. There could be communication barriers between our healthcare teams or just different levels of health literacy, I guess, and understanding what we need to take, when we need to take. And the greater the number of medications you're on, the greater polypharmacy, potentially the greater risk you are of having harm.
So that's when de-prescribing, this notion of actually getting rid of medications potentially becomes really important. How good is the health profession at de-prescribing?
I think it really depends on an individual's level of comfort with de-prescribing medications, as well as how the person also feels about it. For example, you've got a patient cohort that is really pro-removing medicines. You know, they're the people that say, oh gosh, I feel like I'm rattling and is there anything I can stop taking, or I'm sure one of these medicines might be making me feel sick. And sometimes we don't even know as clinicians why they're always on these medications. And so in my role as a home medication review pharmacist, I get to review all the medicines that people are on and often support my GP colleagues in sort of understanding why this medication was started, when it was started, what the patient thinks it's for, and potentially start that conversation and start that buy-in from the person that potentially they're on a medication that could be causing them harm. One of my pet hates is making that statement of you're going to be on this medication for life. Mm. When patients hear that, they truly believe it and they will never forget it. You know, sometimes I go into people's homes as part of this HMR home medicine review program, and they told me that Dr. X prescribed this medicine for them 25 years ago and they said they'd be on it for the rest of their life. And I sort of, you know, delve into it deeper. Well, Dr. X actually retired 10 years ago and medication moves on and we're learning things and developing new drugs and there are new medicines coming out all the time that could potentially be better. You know, we used to say, what was the expression? An aspirin a day keeps the doctor away. Well, you know, that
things
thought process
are different.
Has really moved on. Exactly.
That's so you've right. just mentioned, Deb, this home medicines review, which is where a pharmacist can go into the home, look at what someone is taking and provide really good advice to the regular GP, for instance, on what could potentially be removed, what might be interacting, what might be causing the side effect of cough or falls. A lot of people might be listening going, never heard of it. How do people access it? Can you self-refer as a patient?
Oh, I wish. So that's one of the main barriers to the program, actually, is, you know, while I love my GP colleagues, they're the only ones who can refer to a pharmacist, especially trained pharmacist like myself, who's done a couple extra degrees on top of pharmacy to get this. So a best way for a patient to, I guess, self-refer is to actually speak to their GP, which is super important because it really doesn't matter what I do in the person's home or, you know, come up with a great de-prescribing regime. It's got to go back to the GP at the end of the day to get that go ahead and they can say, yes, this is appropriate and go from there. But the other unfortunate barrier, and I think it's because of particularly funding issues, is I'm actually only allowed to see 30 patients a month.
Okay.
So I'm only allowed to provide reviews for 30 people. So that means, you know, if there's 20 working days, if we're doing Monday to Friday, that's 1.5 people a day.
But you're also in a remote community, like in a regional community. So
I am, yes.
I imagine there's not many people doing what you do.
No.
So Deb, in your time, are there any specific patient examples that stick out to you where you've done a review and it's led to really significant positive outcomes?
Yeah, I've got hundreds, but I guess the main ones that stick out for me are those ones that have really turned people's lives around. So quite often I'll get a referral for a home medicine review because someone's had a fall and the GP or their carer or whoever has initiated it. You know, I'm thinking about this one particular lady who's still living at home and that's her goal. She wants to stay home with her husband and she's mentally firing all fours, like she's completely cognitively with it, but she kept on having falls time and time again. And when I reviewed her medicine, she was on quite a substantial dosing of opioids in combination with some medications that lower her blood pressure, in combinations with some other medicines that she was using to help with urinary frequency. So they're sort of medicines that dry you up. And so all three of those classes of medicines, of which she was on multiple, so she was probably on 6 or 7 of them, all together can contribute to the risk of falls, either through lowering blood pressure, making her a bit unsteady, and she was on a walker as well. Mm. And incredibly, we sort of focused on the opioids because her blood pressure sort of needed those medications. So we focused on the pain medicines and the medicines that wasn't even really helping with her urinary issues. And so we, over time, because quite often with de-prescribing, we go low, we go slow.
Oh, so slowly.
Yes, very slowly. Yes. Yeah, so we actually find that the slower you go, the more success you'll have. And that's actually a big problem with de-prescribing is that we find that sometimes people just chop out a medicine so quickly, don't review it. And of course, it doesn't work. And of course, we get these rebound symptoms or these withdrawal symptoms. And then now we're in a position where the patient is no longer trusting of the deprescribing process and the clinician may no longer be trusting of the deprescribing process. So we're actually starting even further back than we were. So depending on the medicine, of course, some medicines we can just chop out, but medicines that cross the blood-brain barrier, so pain medicines, antidepressants, all those sorts of types of medicines, we like to go very slow and reassess at every step. But going back to the lady who we did take, so I actually set up a protocol for the GP. I sort of said, all right, weeks 2 to 4, let's decrease by this much. Weeks 6 to 8, let's decrease by this much. And of course, monitoring and all the rest along the way. And we managed to, I think we halved her opioid dose because sometimes we can't stop these things altogether and that's okay. But that was enough to stop her falling every second day. And she was so grateful.
Deborah Hawthorne, who's a consultant pharmacist in rural Victoria. There's also a story that some of our colleagues, Caitlin Davey and Jacinta Bowler, have done that's further around the home medicines review and what it could potentially look like if there was more funding, and that's going to be in the show notes.
On ABC Radio National, you're with a health report. So what's in the mailbag?
We have had Marilyn write in. Marilyn says, "Dear Norman and Priya, I'm from Toronto, Canada, and I always learn a lot from listening to your show, The Health Report."
And we should just do a call out to our Canadian listeners because we are on CBC Radio nationally every week.
In Canada?
That's where Toronto is, yeah, Canada. Huh. But across the nation, every province and territory listens.
How did I not know about it?
Well, your friends in Canada don't get up early enough in the morning.
Wow. Well, that's so exciting.
It is exciting.
So Marilyn writes, I was glad to hear the correction made about home birds in Australia. So this is referring to a story now 2 weeks ago where we talked about new guidelines in Victoria for safer newborn and maternity care. And Marilyn says, as it really stunned me when it sounded as if regulated home births weren't done in Australia. I had my son at home in Toronto 31 years ago with regulated midwives paid by our healthcare system. So thank you for that correction. And what we did correct is that there are, in fact, many home birth programs publicly funded in Australia, and that Tasmania was the most recent state to join onto the bandwagon.
And Marilyn goes on to say, you're often really good at explaining minor things that you mentioned, but there was something that Norman said, oh, I'm sorry, Marilyn, on the show about osteoarthritis and exercise. Like, Norman, I have osteo in my knee and probably in my hips, and I exercise in different ways and ride my bike a lot, and so far, so good. My partner has arthritis in his hands, which doesn't stop him playing beautiful music on his guitar mandolin. It's obviously a rich life in Toronto. Norman mentioned that hand arthritis is metabolic and suggested it was different from arthritis in the knees and hips. But you didn't explain what that means or what the difference is. I could look it up, but I'd love to hear an explanation of what metabolic arthritis is. Well, it was shorthand, but what I was talking about is that you normally think of arthritis as wear and tear. So you get it in your hips, you get it in your knees, or where you've had an injury. You might have been playing football and you hurt your shoulder, you damage your shoulder, and over time that previous injury causes arthritis. Sport is a major cause of arthritis. Sport injuries are often preventable. But there's no weight bearing or injury really of the hands. So it's always been a mystery as to why people get arthritis. And the thought is that it's actually a reflection of inflammation elsewhere in your body. So it sounds as if your husband is or your partner is really quite healthy. But some people with hand arthritis can be a little bit overweight and they could have inflammation elsewhere in their body. Obviously, some people with hand arthritis could actually have not osteoarthritis, but an autoimmune form of arthritis, such as rheumatoid arthritis, which does affect the hands. So if you get hand arthritis, you do need to see your GP to get the right blood test in case it's rheumatoid, because there are specific treatments for that. But if it's osteo, it can just be a reflection of inflammation elsewhere in the body. And that's what I was talking about. So people with diabetes, type 2 diabetes, can get hand arthritis. People are a bit overweight and so on. I hope that explains it.
We also had Zalia write in, who says, thank you for sharing such valuable health information. The details from your program about statins having 4 major side effects, including ankle swelling, really resonated with us.
We debated whether or not we should actually read this out, but I'm going to read it out because I think that it highlights some of the vulnerabilities to non-evidence-based care. So Zalia writes, her partner experienced ankle swelling for a long time. And she'd been to see her GP and went to see a rheumatologist and orthopaedic surgeon and, in fact, had been prescribed prednisone for the ankle swelling, which took our breath away because that's not what you prescribe for ankle swelling, is it?
Well, I always say I never know what the clinician saw, but it's an interesting choice, unless you think it is an inflammatory. It's an interesting choice to prescribe a steroid, an oral steroid, for bilateral ankle swelling, because we tend to think about other things like heart failure, albumin,
issues. There is some evidence about, you know, we were talking about deprescribing earlier, but there's also inappropriate prescribing.
Yes.
And people talk about, for example, when you've got reflux rushing to the strongest antacids, when there are weaker antacids which can have an effect and so on. But there's probably inappropriate prescribing of antibiotics, but there's probably inappropriate prescribing of prednisone, which is a toxic drug.
Well, I think there's inappropriate prescribing of everything. I mean, Deb mentioned that in the deprescribing polypharmacy interview. I think that, you know, medication misadventure can occur. And sometimes steroids, I've seen oral steroids prescribed for people where there's not a clear indication, and we're talking about prednisolone. And Norman, it can impact your bone density. It can increase your risk of kind of impaired glucose tolerance or type 2 diabetes. It has serious potential consequences. I have to have a very good reason to be giving someone oral prednisolone. And I don't know what they saw, but what was the clinical indication?
Anyway, Saliha has been consulting with her GP, has stopped the statin, the swelling has died down, and they're going to go on to alternate medications for their cholesterol. So you know, the intention here is don't stop your statin without talking to your GP, because you need to keep those cholesterol levels down.
And of course, that story was about the fact that lots of side effects get blamed on statins. And really, our story in the news that time was about, hey, a lot of them are not actually based in evidence. The research is saying that they can't be attributed to statins. So they're actually probably quite well tolerated. And in this case, yeah, I agree, do it with a health professional. Please write to us, though. You can tell that we love it. Our address is healthreport@abc.net.au.
And on our sister podcast, What's That Rash? This week, we talk about peptides, those mysterious compounds which are turning out to be a massive industry. And we'll give you a horror story that will cross your legs and have your eyes watering.
Wow. On that note, I'll see you next week.